Peretz is an Israeli writer, journalist, and translator who lives in Jerusalem, Israel. Born in Vienna, Austria in 1933, his family fled to Britain in 1938 to escape the Nazi Holocaust. He migrated to Israel in 1951 and was a kibbutz member for 20 years. In Israel, military service is required of all its citizens, including those whose conscience says it's wrong to kill. Peretz Kidron is a former reservist, among the first to refuse service in the occupied territories as far back as the 70s. In 1979, he translated Yitzhak Rabin's memoirs and leaked a passage to the New York Times. Kidron knew just how explosive those few paragraphs would be. The lines were not in Rabin's book because they had been excised by Israeli censors. The passage told how Rabin, then a 26-year-old brigade commander, was ordered by Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion to expel 50,000 Arabs from the villages of Ramleh and Lod during the War of Independence. Peretz Kidron is a board member of B'Tselem and has long been active with Yesh Gavul, Hebrew for "There is a Limit," a group that supports soldiers who refuse to serve in the West Bank and Gaza. His recent book, Refusenik, is an anthology covering 30 years of Israel's refusal movement and tells the stories of the Israeli soldiers who believe in their country but not in its actions beyond its borders. The book features numerous declarations and personal testimonies by these refuseniks from the 1982 invasion of Lebanon up to the current Palestinian situation. Peretz Kidron was recently in Santa Cruz, and I had an opportunity to speak with him at length. He begins here by discussing the founding of the group Yesh Gavul. Peretz Kidron.
It started as a result of two conflicting needs. When people were active in the anti-occupation movement from the beginning, particularly in the 70s, found themselves in this very difficult situation when they were called up every year to do a month's military reserve service, and very often found themselves serving in the occupied territories. So there was this terrible dilemma that was created when you spend 11 months in the year campaigning against something that you consider illegal, immoral, repressive, and everything else. And then in the 12th month, you're actually enforcing and policing that same regime. So that created an impossible dilemma, and numbers of political activists started refusing to serve in the occupied territories, and in time it became necessary to get together, form a group for mutual support and assistance, and that's how Yesh Gavul was formed in 1982 in June, actually motivated directly by the invasion of Lebanon.
In that time, there have been more than 1,200 soldiers who have refused to serve in the occupied territories. Is that correct?
Oh, no, the numbers are much greater. We've had different petitions put forward at different times. Just in the Lebanon War, we had over 3,000 signatures on our petition. We know of 168 soldiers who went to prison for refusal. And the number who go to prison is always a fraction because there are very many refuseniks who, for one reason or other, are not prosecuted. So we can assume that the number is probably several times as large. The number at the moment, the number of refuseniks, and that's the number of people who are actively involved with the military. I, for instance, am no longer a reservist due to age, but of the people involved with the military, that's soldiers, reservists, conscripts about to be inducted into the army, persons of military age, the number of refuseniks is approximately 1,400. Of that number, I would say that probably well over half have already refused on at least one occasion, and over 300 have gone to prison on at least one occasion, and quite a number of them have been imprisoned repeatedly.
What is the makeup of the refusal movement, the refusenik movement?
Well, it's a pretty broad representation of the Israeli Jewish left, because it's only Jews who are recruited into the Israeli army, so obviously it doesn't reflect the Palestinian minority who make up nearly 20% of the population. But of the Jewish population, it's a pretty broad representation. Though obviously it's rather heavy on middle class people, Ashkenazi origin, and university graduates, usually people who are with higher education. And in the army, I would say an undue proportion of combat officers, from lieutenant up to major and colonel, which is a very significant element in the army.
Why is it that you think that many of the refuseniks are of older age? They tend to be in their 30s, is that generally correct?
Well, that was correct until a couple of years ago, and that was mainly due to the fact that the youngsters who join the army are pretty overawed by the military hierarchy and the discipline and the fear of punishment. So until recently, very few younger soldiers or pre-army students were involved with the refusenik movement, which was largely a movement of reservists, namely people who had done their 3 years of military service and were now called back for a month in the year. And being older, more mature, more politically aware, and also less daunted by the whole military structure, and drawing on the fact also that the reserve units are generally, the discipline there is generally not so tight. For all these reasons, the refusenik movement was 90% or more reservists. That has changed in the past couple of years when we have a new development of the refusenik movement amongst high school kids. And this was a wonderful initiative which they undertook by themselves without instruction or direction from any of the older groups. And 10 of them got together, 16, 17-year-olds who'd been involved in anti-occupation activity. They got together and drafted a joint letter to Sharon, putting him on notice that they would refuse to take part in repression of the Palestinian population. They started off with 10 signatures. They published it with 62. And currently there are over 500 high school kids who have signed this declaration, and that's a very significant number. Now, don't forget, when I speak about figures, to make a comparison with the United States, you would have to multiply by a factor of between 40 and 50. So just imagine the effect in this country if something over 20,000 high school students all over the United States sent a similar declaration. I think it would have a major effect on the political arena. And this is a very important development in the refusal movement. And in Yesh Gvul, we've shifted our emphasis to much more education work amongst youngsters, holding seminars and leafleting, and trying to get them aware of the issues involved in the occupation, the human rights abuses, the war crimes, the responsibility under the Fourth Geneva Convention, and so on. Ultimately, the problem falls back into the lap of each individual. It's up to him or her what is done about it, but the intent is to raise awareness so they know what the score is.
Talk more about the outreach programs Yesh Gvul employs to reach out to soldiers currently serving. How do you reach out to men and women in the military?
Well, that's very difficult because obviously we're not welcome inside military camps, but we do go to places where soldiers or reservists congregate. We're active on university campuses. We go leafleting on weekends where soldiers are on their way to and from their units. Wherever we can find congregations of young people, and we also mount events. Sometimes we hold rock concerts or things of that nature, and we publicize them to the best of our ability with flyers and newspaper ads, because on the whole the media is not particularly open to our message, but so we have to put in paid advertisements announcing these events and trying to attract young people to discuss these issues.
I'd like to shift gears for a moment and have you talk about your understanding of the term Zionism and what it means to you.
Zionism is a useless term because it means so many things to so many different people that I think it's redundant. What we have is a state in which the majority are ethnically Jewish, where there's a strong sense of national identity, and where that national identity has been distorted in in some way under the title of Zionism for expansionism and for oppression of the neighboring people. And I think the issue is no longer one of Zionism. That was an issue that was resolved in 1948 or possibly in a few years after it. You might say the final issue of Zionism was resolved with when the Soviet Union allowed Russian Jews to emigrate to Israel. So whoever wants to come and live in a country where a majority of the population is Jewish has been free to do so now for a number of years. And therefore, I think the whole issue of Zionism as such is a matter for the historians and the people who can deal with the ethics and the rights and wrongs. Let me make a comparison. Just as the issue of manifest destiny is no longer a hot issue in American politics, you can argue the rights and wrongs of it, but if you're talking about American politics, you have to relate to the United States as an entity with a nation, with a national consciousness, and that's a fact of life, and the question is what you do with that fact of life as the basis for your political activity. So in the same way, Israel is a fact of life. This is something that has been recognized by the majority of the neighboring nations. What they're displeased by and worried over is Israeli expansionism, and that's the issue that's on the table. I don't think it has anything much to do with historical Zionism. However much the extreme right wing try to invoke this, because they use the biblical concept of a promised land. Well, if they're really going to go for the promised land as defined in the Bible, we have a major problem, because the definition there goes all the way from the Euphrates to the Nile, which would require Israel to occupy half of Egypt, all of Jordan, a chunk of Lebanon, most of Syria, and half of Iraq. I don't think that anybody is actively considering that. So the pretense that somehow by expanding a few miles to the east at the expense of the Palestinians, we're somehow fulfilling the divine prophecy doesn't even go so far as reading the Bible.
Well, what about the issue of accepting Jews from all over the world to come and immigrate into Israel? Do you think that there should be a limit to that in terms of land appropriation and such? It doesn't seem that the land mass can hold much more immigration.
I don't think that that's really the issue. You find that many countries in the world have ethnic preferences. Germany welcomes what they call ethnic Germans from various parts of the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. People have had little or no contact with the German nation over many centuries, and they're welcomed and given preferential treatment when coming to Germany as compared to other immigrants who are far less welcome. So it's not a unique concept. The question of the absorptive capacity, well, you know, these things are flexible. Nowadays, you don't need that much territory. What you need is an economy that can support people, give them jobs, give them housing. And in that sense, Israel is not crowded. It's a fairly crowded country. Obviously, we would be much more comfortable if there were more land. But we have to take the existing resources and use them to the best of our abilities and build a decent environment.
Last night in your talk, you spoke about the term occupation, and you said that the Hebrew term for occupation is much more descriptive of what is really taking place there. Maybe can you comment on these thoughts for our listeners?
Okay, I think that many people in this country don't understand what occupation is about. It's a very tepid term. The Hebrew term is kibush, which comes from the same word as the crushing of grapes the crushing of olives to extract the oil from them. And that, I think, is a much closer description of what an occupation is about. An occupation is an application of force. It's an act of force. It's an act of violence. Even when it's accomplished without a single shot being fired, the mere fact that it's carried out by an army imposing its will on a civilian population makes it an act of force. And it remains an act of force for as long as that occupation lasts. We've seen colonial occupations that lasted hundreds of years. And throughout that period, the colonial power maintained its occupation by a military presence that was designed to subjugate and terrorize the local population so that no resistance is offered to the occupying power. So it's in these terms that you have to regard an occupation. An occupation is an armed group imposing its will on an unarmed group, and in that sense, it's the exact equivalent of a hijacking. It's a hijacking on a much larger scale and over a much longer time period than we're used to thinking of the term. With the occupation, the occupied population is stripped of all its rights. The only law is the law of the gun, whereby the occupier imposes his will, and he thereby can issue all the decrees and regulations. He can order the captive population to do whatever he wishes. He can impose a curfew. He can demolish houses. He can limit movement from one place to the other. He can prevent people from going to work or going to school or university or hospital it's all entirely up to the occupier. He can be a benevolent tyrant or he can be a cruel tyrant. Whatever happens, he's a tyrant. He's in total control, and the captive population becomes exactly that. It's captive with no rights of its own.
There's a line of thought that says if the Israeli government eases back on the occupation, that the Palestinians will rise up and drive them into the sea. How do you respond to these arguments?
That's absurd. Israel is the strongest military power between the Atlantic Ocean and the Indian Ocean. Israel has made peace with Egypt, which is a powerful country with a population of approaching, I believe, 80 million, with almost as much up-to-date American military hardware as Israel possesses. That peace has kept Israel's southern border secure for over 30 years. For 30 years, Israelis and Egyptians haven't been killing one another. So we were given the same warning before that peace treaty too. We were told that the Egyptians have nothing better to do. The only thing they have on their minds is when the appropriate moment will come for them to drive Israel into the sea. Well, they've let 30 years pass by, and we're still on dry land. So I don't know when they intend to carry out this dastardly design. And the idea that Israel has anything to fear from a Palestinian population of 3 or 4 million, with only the rudimentary foundations of a state and an economy and a modern army, is really. This is really totally artificial paranoia, deliberately driving people, deliberate scaremongering in order to create a sense of panic and swing the Israeli population behind a policy of repression. It's nonsense.
You talked also about how history has no real bearing on present-day events in the Middle East. Can you comment on these thoughts?
I wouldn't say that doesn't have a bearing. I would say that in trying to find a political solution for the issue that exists nowadays, it makes very little difference how you regard the events of 1929 when Palestinian Arabs attacked Palestinian Jews, or the events of 1948. They're very important. Historians have to learn them and study them and analyze and try and discover what went on. But they have very little bearing on the situation now. And I find the discussions of history are usually counterproductive. But as a general principle, I would say that history is taught in schools all over the world as a way of indoctrinating children and teaching them to hate the national enemies, the traditional enemies. And history does very little towards international understanding. Just look at Europe. Any European child in any country, if he or she learns that country's history, it will be a history of endless conflicts with the neighbors to the north, to the south, to the east and the west. And that can only entrench hatreds and resentments against these neighbors. And the actual fact is that Europe is built not on history, but on the present-day needs of its peoples, and as a result of that, it's been able to build cooperation and break down barriers. So I would say, leave history to the historians and let's deal with the present-day issues. It makes very little difference today who created the Palestinian refugee problem, but it exists. And certainly Israel has a considerable share in having created it. And that problem has to be resolved, because until it's resolved, Israel won't be at peace. And therefore, Israel has as much of a vested interest in resolving the refugee problem as any other country in the region.
What do you view as fueling the Arab resistance to the occupation?
Every occupation fuels its own resistance. Every occupation, as I've said, is an act of violence against the population. And since nobody likes to be subjected to violence, sooner or later, the population under occupation begins to resist in different ways, with non-violence or violence, whether it was Gandhi with his tactics or the various colonial countries where there were military uprisings that were sometimes very bloody and lasted for many years. If you were going to look at the history of this country, just go back to George Washington and what he did. It's part of the mechanics of occupation. Every occupation throughout history, and this goes back to the Roman Empire and earlier, every occupation fuels resistance. And even in the Jewish tradition, we have one of our annual festivals, the festival of Hanukkah, represents a traditional war of liberation against the foreign occupier. It was carried out in exactly the same way that such wars of liberation have been carried out throughout Asia and Africa and other countries. So it's not a new concept. It's a dynamic that's created by the act of occupation, and everything else that follows is almost a foregone conclusion.
In your view, the Refusnik movement. Do you believe that the soldiers should refuse every order or just the ones that they find to be unjust?
No. Refusing every order assumes that you delegitimize the army. Now, I'm not fond of the army, but in a world of national states and national sovereignty, national armies are part of that scheme of things. I hope to see that will end one day, but as long as it exists, the existence of an army should be accepted as a fact of life. And indeed, I go further. I'm very much in favor of conscription. I believe that suspending the draft in this country and conscription in European countries was a very bad mistake, which undermined the minimum of democratic control that existed beforehand. So I believe that soldiers, that young people who come of age should serve in the army. There should be a law requiring service in the army. But that law should also lay down that the army is restricted to legitimate duties of national defense, and certainly should outlaw offense against neighboring countries or other countries, repression of the population. The army should be strictly forbidden to intervene in any way in domestic politics or domestic affairs in any other way. I'm old enough to remember times when the army was called in regularly to break strikes in Europe, and I believe in this country as well. So I believe that the orders referring to legitimate duties, training for defense, learning to defend one's country, that's okay, that's legitimate. Anything going beyond that, beyond the national borders, that's a point where soldiers should start asking some very, very incisive questions and listening as much to their own convictions as to the orders they get from their commanders.
You're listening to an interview with Peretz Kidron, author of the recent book Refusnik, an anthology covering 30 years of Israeli military refusal movement. I had an opportunity to speak with Peretz on a recent visit to Santa Cruz, and we're talking about a lot of issues. We're going to hear the rest of that next on Rockin' the Boat. Stand by.
Yesh Gavul has a term, the black flag of illegality. Maybe you can comment on this idea.
Well, it's not actually the term was not coined by Yesh Gavul. It's a term from the Israeli legal code, and it refers to a very famous trial that was held in the 50s after a massacre. And some of the soldiers who were involved in that massacre defended themselves with the claim, I was just a soldier, I was just obeying orders. And this was shortly after the Nuremberg trials, after World War II, and Israeli opinion was very much offended, very much up in arms against that particular pretext. And the result was that the judges, too, issued a very clear verdict which made it obligatory for a soldier to refuse to disobey an order if it's clearly illegal. And they use the term the black flag of illegality, namely something that's so clearly illegal that you don't need to be a lawyer to work out the details of it. It's anyone, any normal person with a normal sense of values will know that it's an illegal order. So that term is actually one that we share with the Israeli army. The question is how you interpret that term. And we interpret it much more broadly than the army does. The army would say, if you're told to shoot at a bunch of civilians who are doing nothing at all, that's an illegal order. But we say that the occupation in itself and of itself is a blatantly illegal state of affairs, and therefore anything to do with the occupation and enforcing the occupation comes under that black flag. Or to put it a different way, the enormous black flag flies over the whole of the occupation regime. Underneath that flag, there are thousands and tens of thousands of smaller black flags that fly over thousands and tens of thousands of everyday incidents of humiliation and dehumanization and harassment and exploitation and takeover of land and everything else that goes along with the occupation. So we focus on the big black flag, and we say that black flag signifies to any person of conscience that the occupation must end and that it's immoral and unjustified to serve the occupation.
You yourself were a refusenik. Maybe can you talk a bit about your own circumstances, what led you to question the activities of the Israeli army?
Well, I was active fairly early after the occupation. I became active in the anti-occupation movement, which began to almost immediately after the 67 war. And we were involved in protests against the relatively benign activities. In hindsight, they were indeed, compared to what happens today, it was a very benign kind of occupation at that time. But nevertheless, we protested against the takeover of land, the restrictions imposed on Palestinians, the first settlements that were created by Jewish hardliners. And we were active in that. And pretty soon we became aware of this dilemma, this discrepancy between our convictions and what we were required to do when we did our annual month of reserve service. And the question of refusal came up out of a double pressure. On the one hand, it was then the norm, and still is to a considerable extent, for Israelis of military age to serve in the reserves and not to evade that duty. On the other hand, there was the pressure created by our own convictions that we couldn't possibly continue serving the occupation. So this was discussed at length, and several of my friends began refusing in the early 70s, and they were sent to prison and so on. It was quite a quite a sensational event, and there was a lot of public controversy around it. I hadn't yet made up my mind. Frankly, I was scared of the consequences, not so much for myself in person, because military prison isn't really that much of a deterrent, but I was very worried about the consequences for my children, for instance, who were at school in a kibbutz with a strong military tradition. And it was only, I must say that they were, my son had already finished school, he graduated and was himself in the army. It was only then, and my daughter was nearly at the end of her schooling, it was only then that I plucked up the courage to register my own refusal. And also it was a matter of this awareness maturing that I couldn't possibly reconcile it with my own conscience to continue serving the occupation regime, which I considered to be totally illegal and totally immoral.
What kind of reaction did you receive from your men in your unit, other people in the military, maybe family members who might not have agreed with your decisions?
Well, I didn't encounter that much active hostility. Most of my friends were on the left, so I didn't have any problem with my social circle. My family, well, there's some I preferred not to discuss it with because I could imagine what kind of reaction I would get. But in a wider sense, I was actually amazed by the degree of tolerance shown. Because I put it very plainly, I said, this is my conviction and I'm prepared to go to prison over my conviction. Now it's up to you, namely my officers and so on, it's up to you to decide what to do with me. And when it was put to them in these terms, I was surprised to find that even extreme right-wingers were prepared to respect my convictions. I served with a Jerusalem unit, and Jerusalem, you should know, is considered the most right-wing city in Israel. And the joke in our unit was that the officers who belonged to the Likud, the party of Sharon, they were the left-wingers relatively to the general position of most of the people in the unit. So it wasn't because people were sympathetic to my political views, but when I put matters in that way, I was actually given quite a degree of respect and quite a hearing, which is another aspect of the refusal movement. I think that there are many Israelis who have absolutely no tie, they're totally opposed to most of the peace movements, but when a refusenik comes along and expresses his point of view, he at least is given a reasonable hearing, or more so than anyone else. And I think that stems from this willingness to take punishment. It's part of the code of non-violent civil disobedience. After all, that is what refusal is about. It's applying the strategy and philosophy of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. to an army. They'd never thought of that, but we simply took the same principles, applied them in the army, and were prepared to take the punishment because we recognized that legally we were breaking a law and therefore we were up for punishment. So this willingness made the whole thing above board, and people were willing to listen in many cases.
What impact do you think the refusenik movement is having on Israeli society in terms of the general discourse of the occupation within Israel?
Well, I think that the refusal movement has a two-pronged impact. First of all, it has a very strong effect on the anti-occupation movement and the peace movement in general, which have been going through some very difficult times in recent years, and many people have dropped out and have become inactive or disillusioned, cynical, tend to sit on the fence. And the fact that the peace movement is picking up again and many people are coming out of their cubby holes to take an active part in it is in part at least due to the refusenik movement, because it kind of it squeezes the conscience. It's the sort of moral blackmail that the Refusnik movement exerts on other people. Look, we're prepared to go to prison. What are you prepared to do? Aren't you at least prepared to go to a picket, a vigil, a demonstration? I think it has that effect. Certainly the peace movement has picked up, and there are very many groups active against the occupation, against the partition wall, and all these other aspects of the occupation. The other prong of the refusal movement is that, unlike other protest movements, it has a direct effect on the decision makers. And let me show you two opposite illustrations. In the United Kingdom, a year and a half ago, 2 million demonstrators took to the streets to object to the invasion of Iraq. And they shouted their slogans, and when they finished the demonstration, they went home, and then Tony Blair ordered the British Army to Iraq, and with the exception of 3 soldiers, I think a total of 20,000 British troops went out to Iraq. I think things would have been different if there had been 50 or 100 refuseniks among those British soldiers. Maybe the conduct of the British government would have been different. By contrast, I'll mention something from Israeli history, not that ancient. In the 80s, when Israel invaded Lebanon, that was the beginning of the organized refusenik movement. And the invasion came in 1982. 1984, the general staff and the military establishment recommended an end to the campaign in the Beirut area. And that recommendation was adopted by the cabinet, and the occupation didn't end. The Israeli army was, however, withdrawn to the southern tip of Lebanon. So most of Lebanon was freed from the Israeli occupation. A few years later, the man who'd been commander at the time of the recommendation was asked why he had made it. And he gave a number of reasons, and one of them was the following, and I quote, "At that time, refusals were running in the hundreds, and we were afraid that pretty soon they'd run in the thousands and tens of thousands." And I think that expresses a very important element of the refusnik movement, the inherent threat that this could become contagious. Therefore, the figures of the present number of refuseniks are important, but what the army would like to know and can't possibly guess is how many soldiers, in addition, how many are close to refusal, how many are considering it and would do so if placed under additional provocation. So that's the power, that to use a military term, that's the deterrent power of the refusnik movement, because it becomes a factor that the strategists, the military commanders, have to bear in mind, because they're afraid that their army will fall apart. That, in fact, was what Moshe Levy said about Lebanon. He was afraid that the army would fall apart. Indeed, at that time, the army refrained from calling up a brigade of paratroopers, because they'd learned somehow that there were many refuseniks there, and the army didn't want the humiliation of calling in a whole unit and finding that half of them didn't turn up. So that's the other aspect of the refusnik movement. And in general, the refusnik movement has livened up the debate. Everybody in Israel is aware of the existence of the refusnik movement, and it's sharpened the debate and the controversy over the occupation and all its aspects, in particular the moral aspect, because the refusniks bring home the fact that aside from the enormous material damage that the occupation does to Israel, it's destroyed our economy, which is in recession, it's destroyed our tourist trade, it's cost billions, and we have widespread poverty, widespread inequality on a scale we'd ever had before. On top of that, it also has a very damaging effect on the morality of the Israeli society, which has become much more violent than it ever was in the past. So all these elements are sharpened and placed before on the public agenda by the existence of the refusnik movement.
I guess on a final thought then, maybe how can the refusal movement work together with other areas of the peace movement, and I don't know, I mean, how do we get the occupation to stop, I guess is really what my question is, and how can all these elements come together to make that change?
Well, the elements of cooperation with other peace groups and with Palestinian groups already exist. There's an informal grassroots coalition which works very closely together, and many members of Yesh Gvul are members of other groups as well. So informally, there are a lot of ties and a lot of activities which are held together by the various groups of the refusing community and other anti-occupation groups. The question of bringing the occupation to an end depends on a lot of very major factors. One of them is whether we can revive in the Israeli public a belief in peace and the desire for dialogue with the Palestinians. At the moment, the majority of Israelis are prepared to go along with all sorts of unilateral measures which the Israeli government decides on for its own good or bad or evil intentions. And these moves are then imposed on the Palestinian people or on other neighbors. Israel decides to withdraw from Lebanon 4 years ago, and that decision was carried out unilaterally. There was no consultation or discussion with the Lebanese authorities. Ariel Sharon now plans a partial withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, again for his own good reasons and having very little to do with the welfare of the Palestinian people. That isn't discussed with the Palestinians because he claims that there's nobody to speak to. So what we have to do is revive in the Israeli people an understanding that we live in the Middle East and that we have to achieve peace with our neighbors. It makes no sense to be on peaceful terms with California. We have to be on peaceful terms with the Palestinians because they live right next door to us. So that awareness has to be revived. It's very difficult in the present climate of the Intifada and the mutual violence and the bloodshed that we've experienced in the past 4 years. But that has to be a very essential priority. Another one is, of course, the international aspect. And here it's very important to stress that the occupation could only have lasted this long due to the massive assistance provided by the United States under successive administrations. They have bankrolled the Israeli occupation. They provided the arms and the diplomatic support that Israel needs, and also physically the money, because otherwise, in simple terms, Israelis would have to choose between guns or butter. They would have to choose between their own living standards or pouring money into the occupied territories to maintain and expand the settlements and the roads and all the other paraphernalia of the occupation. Because the United States is bankrolling Israel to such an effect, Israelis haven't really been required to tighten their belts until recently. And so the United States is, I would say, responsible, bears a great deal of responsibility for the occupation, and conversely has a lot of potential influence on bringing about an end to the occupation. I'm convinced that if the United States administration were to exert very mild pressure, there's no need to cut off aid or anything else. The fact that Israel is so totally reliant, if a clear signal came from Washington that the United States administration wants the occupation to end, the occupation would end very quickly. Both because the Israeli government realizes its dependence and because the Israeli people regard the association with the United States as vital. And therefore, if it's clear that the United States is no longer prepared to tolerate the occupation, then people, however reluctant and however they view the occupation, they would say that the association with the United States is more important. So there's a very clear responsibility here on the United States and on the American public to realize that they have a share in the occupation, and they too have at some point to say, to use our slogan and say, Yesh Gvul, there's a border, there's a limit to U.S. support, and there's a border that Israel should retreat to and allow the Palestinians their own dignified and independent existence.
Peretz Kidron, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.